If you're a new listener to Renewing Your Mind, we'd like to introduce ourselves to you. Renewing Your Mind is a radio production of Ligonier Ministries with Dr. R.C. Sproul. The purpose of Ligonier Ministries is to awaken as many people as possible to the holiness of God by proclaiming, teaching, and defending God's holiness in all its fullness. In order to fulfill that mission, Ligonier Ministries has been producing Christian education materials designed to fill the gap between Sunday school and seminary. For more than 30 years, we've been accomplishing this mission in many ways. Of course, the Renewing Your Mind broadcast is one of those ways. Every day, the teaching of Dr. R.C. Sproul can be heard on hundreds of radio stations within the United States and throughout the world on shortwave radio. The broadcast can also be heard all over the globe on the World Wide Web, reaching even the most remote places in the world that don't have easy access to the quality Christian education we experience here in the West. We also provide hundreds of audio and video materials covering theology, apologetics, the Christian life, and more, as well as over 60 books written by Dr. Sproul. Another major outreach is through our Bible study magazine, Table Talk. Every day, nearly 55,000 subscribers read daily Bible studies, as well as articles from Dr. Sproul and other prominent Christian teachers. To receive a free copy of this award-winning magazine and get better acquainted with Ligonier Ministries, give us a call at 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343. A resource consultant is waiting for your call. Or you can log on to our website at ligonier.org. That's ligonier.org. What has happened to civic virtue and public morality? Are you prepared to make a change in your culture? Stay tuned. Renewing Your Mind is next. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Renewing Your Mind with teacher and theologian Dr. R.C. Sproul. Whatever happened to the good old days? It seems that Western civilization has lost its sense of decency and its ability to know the difference between right and wrong. But don't assume this problem is unique to our own day. There's an ancient recurring pattern that's been shaping culture throughout the millennia. Do you recognize where we are in the cultural spectrum? Are you prepared to be a voice of truth in your culture? Today, Dr. Sproul will teach us to recognize our current cultural climate and explain the fundamental cause of its decline. With more on that, here's our teacher.
Today, we're going to begin a new series that's sort of a change of pace from many of the things that we do on Renewing Your Mind. We're going to have a short series in the development of the science of apologetics in early church history. Now, when we talk about apologetics, we're not talking about a program by which we say to the world that we're sorry that we are Christians. But the word apologetics comes from the Greek word apologia, which means to make a reply. And in the early church, there were many who rose up to launch an attack against the truth claims of Christianity, both from competing religious circles and also from philosophical circles, not to mention political circles. And there were so many unfounded rumors that went through the Roman Empire by which the Christian faith was being misunderstood and slandered and so on, that the apologists of the early church set out to do two things. One, to clarify exactly what Christianity was proclaiming in order to clear up many of these misunderstandings and distortions that were abounding throughout the area. But perhaps even more importantly, to offer an intellectual defense of the truth claims of the Christian church. The early apologists carried the baggage or the weight of the intellectual articulation of biblical Christianity. Now, the roots of apologetics begin in the New Testament itself. We are told, for example, that as Christians we are to be prepared and ready at any time to give a reason for the hope that lies within us. And perhaps the most famous apologist of the nascent Christian community was the Apostle Paul. We normally think of Paul as a theologian or as a missionary, a church planter, a pastor, an apostle, and he filled all of those roles in a remarkable way. But in addition to those activities, Paul was also an apologist for Christianity. In fact, he was the apologist par excellence of the first century. And if we read, for example, in the book of Acts and other biographical data that Paul sprinkles throughout his epistles, we see the apostle on his missionary journeys going into the synagogue, but not only into the synagogue, but also into the agora, into the marketplace, where he was, as the scriptures tell us, arguing the case for Christianity daily. Now, when I say arguing, I don't mean by that the apostle was given to a contentious, mean-spirited fussing and feuding with people. When we think of arguments today, we think of spats or disagreements that people have that are most unpleasant. But I'm using the term argue here in the classic sense and in a positive way. That is, in the sense of offering a cogent intellectual argument for the truth claims of the Christian faith, much as we see Paul doing, for example, at the Areopagus in Mars Hill, when there he meets in Athens with some of the philosophers of that day, and he enters into public debate with them. And on that occasion, we see Paul functioning as an apologist. Well, when Christianity is introduced into the ancient world, there was a climate in the culture that's very important for us to understand, because the early church not only had to defend her position within the culture, but also had to address the contemporary issues that were alive and raging within that culture. And of course, that is a challenge that the church has to face in every age and in every geographical locality in which the gospel is introduced. Christian apologists, for example, who work in Muslim countries have a different task of defending and clarifying Christianity than they would have if they were dealing with the prevailing philosophies in the Western world. And in every age, there are alternative philosophical systems that are brought to bear against Christianity. And so the apologetic task is always finding itself involved in discussion and debate with whatever the prevailing cultural mindset is, or what we would call the present life and worldview. Now, I'm going to take some time at the beginning of this brief study of the early church mission of apologetics, talking about the cultural situation in which the gospel was born, particularly with respect to the intellectual, religious, and moral climate of the day. And I'm doing that not simply for historical reasons, that we can understand what was going on in the first and second centuries, but because so much of what the early church was encountering in the culture is so similar to what the church is encountering in our own day. The similarities are indeed remarkable, as I think that you will see. In the first place, in the cultural setting of the first century, the Western world, now being dominated by the power of Rome, was living out the radical decline of the influence of the high age of Greek philosophy. In fact, when we even think about philosophy in the ancient world, our minds immediately snap to the grandeur that was Greece. We think of the titans of Greek philosophy, people like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, who ushered in the golden age of Greek philosophical thought. In fact, some historians of philosophy have said that all subsequent philosophical endeavors since Plato and Aristotle have merely been a footnote to the pioneer work that was done by these two giants of the intellectual realm. But of course, Plato and Aristotle did not appear in a cultural vacuum. And so I want to go back a little bit before those two important thinkers to something that had taken place earlier in the ancient world. Philosophy, we're told, begins with the so-called pre-Socratic thinkers. That means those who were the intellectual developers before Socrates. And there were many lesser luminaries that led up to a struggle between two intellectual giants of antiquity. The first was a man by the name of Parmenides. And Parmenides is famous for his one quotation that has survived down to this age, in which Parmenides argued that whatever is, is. Now, I've mentioned him before in other contexts, and I've said the first time I heard that, where Parmenides said, whatever is, is, I laughed. I said, this guy's famous for saying something as obvious and as simple as that. But I've also rued that scorn that I heaped upon the ancient thinker. And as I studied philosophy and theology, I kept coming back to the reality that that is one of the most profound philosophical statements I've ever encountered in my life. But in any case, what he was arguing for was a metaphysical philosophy of being, of isness. Now, his antagonist was a man by the name of Heraclitus, who, incidentally, 20th century existential philosophers have often looked to as being their forefather, indeed the father of existential philosophy, reaching all back through the centuries to this man, Heraclitus, who argued that no, whatever is in a state of change. There is nothing permanent, there's nothing absolute, there is no such thing as pure essence or being. Everything, said Heraclitus, is in a state of becoming. Here, the two greatest thinkers of the age were locked in a battle of ideas where the positions they took were radically opposed to one another. And this led to an impasse in theoretical thought. And out of this impasse in theoretical thought came a whole new atmosphere of intellectual skepticism. And basically what was happening in the marketplace and among the common people was this. If these great geniuses like Heraclitus and Parmenides can't agree about ultimate truth, that must mean that ultimate truth simply cannot be discerned, cannot be discovered. If the greatest minds can't agree on it, then who do we think we are that we would suppose that we could reach the ultimate level in our pursuit of truth? And so attention now was changed away from philosophical speculation towards the highest good and towards the highest truth, and people became much more concerned with simply being practical. And into that philosophical vacuum rushed the movement called sophism. Now, you've maybe heard that term sophism from time to time in somewhat negative terms. If a politician is blustering on and just playing word games, you might accuse that speaker of being guilty of sophistry. Or if we see somebody who has a little bit of knowledge and thinks that they have a lot of knowledge, we may describe that attitude as being sophomoric. The name sophomore, which follows the class of freshmen in high school and college, has its roots in this idea. And then there's the word sophisticated, which in some cases is used in a positive way, but it also can be used in a negative way to refer to those who have mere external, superficial gilding of their appearance, but lack real substance under more careful examination. The sophists were the pragmatists of their day, They were the ones who taught the school of rhetoric. You hear the story of Demosthenes, for example, in his pebbles, where he would put pebbles in his mouth and practice speaking with those pebbles in his mouth to force himself to become more adroit in the forming of words so that he could become more precise in his enunciation and more articulate in his oratory. But when we think of rhetoric today, we think of that which is just flapping the breeze with empty words and phrases. Now, the rhetoricians of the sophist world were not concerned about learning how to speak the truth, but rather they were only concerned with learning the power of speech for persuasion. So that the key in the schools that were growing up, taught by the sophists, was how to learn to be successful in business without really trying. That is, they were the Madison Avenue hype guys of the ancient world. It didn't matter whether the claim was true, because truth could not really be known in the final analysis. All that really mattered was whether by the gift of gab and the gift of polished, sophisticated speaking, one could be persuasive and convince the other person to do what you wanted them to do. And so we had this change in philosophical concern from a quest for ultimate truth and ultimate goodness to a period of skepticism by which people began to think, well, we can't discover ultimate goodness, we can't discover ultimate truth, but we're still left with the practical business of living our daily lives and being successful in the marketplace and so on. Does that sound familiar to you? Well, when that happened, there was an obvious and apparent decline in civic virtue, in public morality, and what was being witnessed at this time was what some historians would call an obvious disintegration of civilization itself. Now, it's into that vacuum that came after that impasse that bred this new spirit of skepticism that the gadfly of Athens entered. And the famous gadfly of Athens was a fellow by the name of Socrates, who was famous for the maxim, "Know thyself." And Socrates, who didn't write anything, and we only know really of his philosophy through the writings of his famous student Plato, but Socrates stepped into this cultural morass and believed that nothing less than Western civilization was at stake. The city-states of Greece were engaged in warfare, and there was an influx and intrusion of barbarianism into the earlier developments of civilization. And Socrates believed, as truth goes, so goes the culture. And he saw sophism as being the mortal enemy of Greek civilization. And so he became a martyr to the cause. As we know, he was executed for corrupting the youth of Athens and was forced to drink the hemlock and so on. But in the meantime, he would go around the city, much as the Apostle Paul did later, pleading his case in the agora, in the marketplace, with students, with intellectually oriented people, challenging them to look more deeply, to challenge the assumptions that they were living by, and revealing that the worldview that these people had adopted following the sophists was only skin deep and had no substance behind it, and basically was a reflection of an abysmal state of ignorance. And so for Socrates, ignorance was the supreme enemy, and he believed that the only thing that could rescue Greek civilization was a new commitment to knowledge that was lasting, to knowledge that was cogent, to knowledge that was solid and stable, and not based simply on the whims of those seeking an economic advantage in the marketplace by persuasion. So truth rather than practicality became the sought-after goal of Socrates. And he developed what we now call the Socratic method, the method of dialogue, where he would engage people and force them not simply to parrot their answers that they had memorized by rote in the schools, but force them to challenge their own assumptions and to think to the next level. And he said that knowledge doesn't really begin until the first step for knowledge takes place, which is the admission of ignorance. The person who assumes that they know everything there is to know or all that's worth knowing is a person who is really unteachable. Sometimes attributed to Socrates, sometimes to somebody else, but the famous saying is, the unexamined life is not worth living. Whether Socrates himself originated that phrase is still a debatable point, but it certainly captures what he was concerned about as he went around the city challenging people to examine their lives, to examine their thinking. Why do you believe what you believe? Why do you think the way you think? Are you just merely imitating the passing conventions and customs of your local culture? Or have you really thought it through? And because of Socrates' work and his stimulation, his pupil, Plato, emerged as the intellectual savior, as it were, of Greek civilization. And some historians have said that had it not been for Socrates, the collapse of ancient civilization would have been much more rapid and much more devastating than actually what did take place later on.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind. That was Dr. R.C. Sproul explaining how a culture rapidly declines once the idea of truth is abandoned. Don't go away. Dr. Sproul will return in just a few moments with some closing thoughts. Today's lecture, Cultural Climate, is the first message in a 14-part series entitled Apologetics of the Early Church. In this series, Dr. Sproul takes us back to the first four centuries to see how the early church apologists answered the critics' attacks against the Christian faith. If you'd like to purchase the Apologetics of the Early Church series, it's available on 5 CDs for $30.40. To order, give us a call using our toll-free number, 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343. You can place an order online at ligonier.org. Ligonier is spelled L-I-G-O-N-I-E-R. Have you ever met a real bona fide atheist? In a world dominated by a belief in a creator, what causes an atheist to embrace unbelief? Today, we'd like to tell you about a gift you can receive for a donation of any amount. During this week on Renewing Your Mind, we're offering a book written by Dr. Sproul entitled, If There Is a God, Why Are There Atheists? In this book, R.C. demonstrates that atheists have a vested interest in denying the existence of God, who claims moral authority over our lives. The book, If There Is a God, Why Are There Atheists? Is available to you for a donation of any amount. Our toll-free number is 1-800-435-4343. Again, that's 1-800-435-4343. Let's join Dr. Sproul again for today's closing thoughts.
Today we've looked briefly at a small element of the ancient situation of the Greek world, and the crisis that came when a period of skepticism arrived to threaten the very heart of civilization itself, and how Socrates stepped into that vacuum and tried to rescue civilization from declining into pure barbarianism. And this was only the first such impasse of the ancient world, and I wanted us to see that because I happen to think that this kind of situation occurs in almost cyclical, repeated patterns throughout history. And it just so happens that we are living in such a time today. and that the task of the church in the 20th century is to address a Western culture and Western civilization that has revived ancient skepticism, that says if there is a God, you can't know Him. If there is truth, it's unknowable. And so we are locked into this world and this time. And so we might as well just pay attention to the daily business of living and be practical rather than theoretical. And then we wonder why the culture around us is going through moral chaos, because we have lost the grounding of what is good based on what is true. And when the pursuit of truth disintegrates, it is inevitable that goodness disintegrates with it.
That'll bring a close to this Tuesday edition of Renewing Your Mind. Thank you for being with us. Join us tomorrow as Dr. Sproul continues his study of early Christian apologetics. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, the listener-supported radio outreach of Ligonier Ministries.